This is a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. You've made the commitment.
You caught the vision.
You want your family to serve God.
But sometimes it's hard to put feet on that vision. Hey, Hal, do visions have feet?
Shh. How do you get from principle to practice?
What do you need to know about the issues affecting your family?
How do you apply God's Word in the 21st century?
Let's talk about it.
This is Making Biblical Family Life Practical with Hal and Melanie Young.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to Making Biblical Family Life Practical. I'm your host, Hal Young. Normally, my beautiful wife, Melanie Young, would be with me, but she, no kidding, woke up with laryngitis, and that makes interview programs kind of a bore. So, with her agreement, I'm going to carry this one on solo. She's had to do it before when I was traveling, and tit for tat is fair. So, want to welcome you. Thank you for joining us again. When Melanie and I started speaking as a regular ministry about 5-6 years ago, one of the things that came to the fore real quick is there seems to be a lot of misunderstanding amongst parents of young boys about the normal development of their sexuality. Particularly, we found mothers really just didn't seem to clue in that the changes are happening sooner in their sons than they would have seen in their daughters. And even more so, they're happening earlier and earlier just as part of the population, just historically, demographically. The transition into puberty is happening sooner and earlier than it ever has been. And one of the things that comes about with that is the developing sexual awareness and also the openness to sexual temptation. And so we started talking about that, certainly not something that we sign up for and really enjoy standing on a stage in front of a room full of strangers and talking about sex, but yet as part of the ministry of parenting boys, that seemed to be something God called us into. Well, one thing that we found as we researched the question and started dealing with some of the issues directly was just the amazing extent that pornography has eaten its way into our culture and has become a real serious ongoing issue for our sons, as well as for all men, really. And so today, our guest is Luke Gilkerson. He is the Educational Resources Manager for a group called Covenant Eyes. Now, we'll be talking about their ministry and some of the things that they offer later in the program, but suffice it at this point to say this is a ministry to families, to individuals, to churches, pastors, whomever, who are trying to combat the problem of lust and porn and the terrible effects that this has on families, on our whole community. Luke, I just want to say welcome.
Thank you so much, Hal, for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you being there, too. When we were young people, and I can say that, I mean, Luke is not quite as old as I am, but I know a generation ago, pornography was there. I mean, they found pornography on the walls in Pompeii. It's nothing new. But the internet has really changed the game, hasn't it?
It has. It has. I'm on the tail end of Gen X. And so millennials today would be the next generation after that. They grew up, depending on where they, where they were or how well off their parents were or whatever. Many of them, in fact, even I would say most of them, grew up with some semblance of pornography in the home. Maybe that was from infancy, or maybe that was just in the tail end of their time at home. So they're looking at, right now, those people are adults. And that's the first generation of people who've been raised with the internet, who are now into adulthood. And, the statistics we're finding is pretty shocking. Shocking if you're not aware of what's online. The amount of pornography that's on the internet is enormous.
So the chances
of seeing that on the internet is huge. And so, especially when the internet was when the World Wide Web anyway was in its infancy, not a lot of people were doing a whole lot of protecting,
right,
or monitoring of those things. Nor were there a lot of resources available to do that. And so, yeah, children were exposed to pornography at a young age. Yeah.
I read recently somebody made the comment that pornography was the first and I think still is the most successful e-commerce application. That it's been a real money pipeline for people that have provided.
It is. It's actually been a driver of internet technologies. You know, so a lot of the things that you more or less take for granted on the internet today, you know, security improvements for a la carte pay services or the pop-up window or those kind of things were all funded by pornography or by the porn industry. They were not just riding on the heels of technology, especially in the early days, they were driving a lot of it. So it was very successful. It's less successful now, in some sense, just because there's so much free porn available out there. And that's been actually kind of a detriment to the business side of it. Of course, the downfall of that, culturally speaking, is that there's even less of a barrier of entry, less of the pay barrier that used to be there to look at porn. Now it's just free and available to everyone. To the extent where anywhere in the range of about 80-90% of people who view porn online only view the free material. It's become very, very affordable in the sense that it's free.
Well, now, yeah, okay, let's talk about that. Now, as I think back to my own childhood, teenage years, you know, if we wanted to watch this kind of junk, and really watching it was much more difficult than finding it in print, but even if we wanted to look at those kind of magazines, you had to resort to things like shoplifting or rummaging in somebody's garage that you knew had a stash of old men's magazines, as they called them. That it was there, but you had to have a certain amount of brazenness to get involved with it. Well, right. You know, initially when stuff came out on the internet, it was there. It was much easier to get to it, but you still had to have a credit card, right?
A lot of it you did, yeah. I mean, the goal was to make money. So, but of course, the internet also the use of the internet also showed people that one of the best ways to get people in was by showing a lot of sample material, sample pornographic material. And this is still a tactic that porn websites use today, where they show a lot of teasers for stuff.
Yeah.
Which is still, it's not just like a movie preview where they're not going to give away the plot. I mean, this is a
there's no plot.
This is blatant, right? This is blatant pornography. It's just shorter clips. And so the goal is to get you kind of tied in or roped in. And so they started doing that from early on. So there was free porn available, but generally speaking, a lot of the gateways into those things, there was still that barrier. I will say though that since use of the internet among youth has become more and more common, the instance of exposure to pornography has only increased.
In terms of
intentional exposures has increased. It's becoming more the norm for people to go after, look for pornography. Unintentional exposure to pornography, so just stumbling upon it, that's actually fluctuated up and down over the years. As technology has gotten better and as parents have become a little more proactive, and as teens have become more educated, unintentional viewing of pornography kind of spiked back in the mid-2000s, and since then it's actually been a bit on the decline, which is good that unintentional porn exposure is on the decline. And that's due to other things, but of course that's just unintentional exposure. There's still plenty of kids and teens who are actually going after and seeking out pornography, which is a scary thing.
Well, that that is something that we found talking with people. So many parents, and especially homeschooling parents, are really trying to protect their children from negative cultural influences, and they think that they've raised the bar high enough. They think, we have our computer in the family room and we monitor carefully all the movies that we watch and, they do all the right things, but it's kind of like these are the right things for 1978. They're not, a lot of them don't seem aware of what has changed because frankly, if you became a believer and this was something that God dealt with many years ago, you may not be clicking on that bait and you may not realize just how pervasive it's gotten.
Yeah, it's gotten quite pervasive, and it's because it goes beyond. I mean, you're right. A computer in a general living space is a nice thing to do. It's good to do that. But anymore, technology is portable. computers, didn't used to be. I mean, of course, laptops have been around for a while, but their ubiquity is, of course, become greater. More people have laptops. You can go anywhere with laptops. Tablets, smartphones, all of these things are portable. So if you're only taking stock of the large desktop thing that sits one place, okay, well, you did that. That's good, but that's certainly not shoring up and protecting as much as you should. When you have... Now, of course, there are a number of families that they have the one computer. It sits in one space, and they don't have it. They don't have more computers anywhere else. And that's okay. That's really? You. That's fine. You don't let your kids have tablets. You don't let your kids have iPhones or Android devices. Okay, well, if that's you, that's you. Great. But that's not the majority of American homes today.
No, it's not.
The majority of American homes have far more devices in them than just the one family computer.
You know, that is so true. And... you know, we talk about this in some of our online webinars, and one of the questions we ask is, how many internet-capable devices do you have in your home? And I can sense a lot of our people, we've had several hundred families go through this same program, a lot of them, it's the first time they really took stock to say, wait a minute, okay, I know the desktop in the family room, and we know my husband's laptop from work, and my tablet goes online, and then they start saying, and how many phones do we have? Oh, and my ebook reader will go online. Oh, and goodness, that's right. We've got a thing on our TV that'll go on. And they start, you know, it's nothing for a family to have 10 or 12 internet-capable devices sitting there around their home. And if it'll go online, it'll go anywhere.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, And so I think a lot of us are just not, we don't catch up. The technology overruns us.
Yes, and in addition, it's one thing for a parent to start to take stock of those things when they notice a problem. So if they catch their son or their daughter going somewhere, either on TV that they shouldn't go, or on the internet that they shouldn't go, or maybe on a gaming device or something like that, that's one thing. Because often parents will kind of take stock of those things right away and say, "Oh, I got to do something about this. This isn't good that they have access to all this stuff," and they'll start figuring that out. And they might take notice of that. If they do, that's great. Hopefully they caught the problem while it's early.
Right.
But what you said in the opening of the program is so true. There is so few parents really realize just how curious even a young child can be before adolescence, before puberty sets in.
Right.
Often not even through any particular fault of parenting or fault of the child even. Sometimes it's the simplest things that provoke those curiosities. And the curiosities themselves aren't necessarily negative or bad or whatever, but they're there. And parents aren't anticipating that those curiosities are going to be there. It's really important for parents to recognize that. You mentioned that, kids are, in some sense, you're more curious earlier, and that's true. That's due in large part to the environment we live in. We live in a very sexualized environment that, even if you shored up and protected your home fairly well, all you have to do is walk out to the grocery store or the mall or, go anywhere. If you rent a movie, what's in the previews? If you, even for that matter, the cartoons kids can watch. Are laced with themes, and not necessarily even just blatantly sexual themes, which is problematic enough as it is, but almost all types of media are laced with relational themes of marriage, themes of romance, themes of attraction. And even if they don't show anything that's going to titillate somebody, they do provoke a sense of curiosity about relationships, curiosity about attraction. Even in the most sometimes innocent types of looking media, it will provoke those kind of curiosities. And again, those curiosities themselves aren't the problem. It's where those curiosities can take them. If if you aren't in a position as a parent to deal with those and talk to your child about those curiosities and really instruct your child through those curiosities, then Google will be more than happy to fill in the blank for you. Wow. And you don't want what Google will give.
Wow. You are so right. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, Luke, we are coming up on a station break. If we can break in for just a moment here and have our revenue break, as one of the talk show hosts talks about, and we'll be right back. We're talking with Luke Gilkerson of Covenant Eyes. We're talking about the problem of porn. Please stay with us.
It's not always easy having sons. Teenage boys put away a startling amount of groceries. Younger boys can be downright destructive. They're noisy, unconcerned with hygiene, and the dog has a longer attention span, or so it seems some days. If these are God's chosen gifts to us, and we believe that they are, then why does it seem so hard? How can we prepare these boys to serve God when we can barely make it through the day? Isn't there a better way? The answer is yes. Raising Real Men, Surviving, Teaching, and Appreciating Boys by Hal and Melanie Young is a practical, award-winning guide to equipping the hearts and minds of boys without breaking or losing your own. John Rosemond says, "This is just what the doctor ordered for parents who want to raise capable Christian men of character." Raising Real Men by Hal and Melanie Young. Visit it on the web at raisingrealmen.com. Brought to you by Great Waters Press.
Well, hello, welcome back. This is Making Biblical Family Life Practical. I'm Hal Young. I'm filling in without my co-host Melanie Young because she's suffering from a loss of voice. But nevertheless, we are talking with Luke Gilkerson. He is the Educational Resource Manager for Covenant Eyes. We're talking about the problem of pornography in the family. And Luke, just before the break, you brought up a very important issue. You were talking about how do you parent in an age that's just, frankly, awash in pornographic images. Now, we talked earlier about the fact that it's becoming really pervasive in our media. What is really, on the average, talking to the whole culture, how early are young people being exposed to these images? What's the average first exposure?
Well, you know what? Different statistics will state different things out there. It depends on when you're getting your stats from. I know people that are quoting statistics that are old as 10 years old, and as far as the internet goes, that's ancient history. So when you're talking about today's youth, or let's just talk about today's millennials, okay? You don't typically go out and survey 6-year-olds or 10-year-olds or even 16-year-olds. There are ethical complications when you're trying to survey minors. So right. Let's just talk about millennials, and you ask them, when was the first time you saw pornography? When you survey, and there's been surveys of some of them in the tens of thousands, generally speaking, boys are seeing pornography for the first time before their teenage years. That's on average.
So you're saying
we're talking 12 is about average. About average for now. That means that for a whole lot of people it was long before 12, and for other people it was a whole lot longer after 12.
You know, anecdotally, as we started talking about this, you know, people come because when a speaker comes from out of town, they're safe. You can unload things and know he's going to carry it off like a scapegoat. And when we first started talking about it, people were coming up saying, "I'm so glad you're bringing this up because my 16-year-old is struggling." Now we're hearing over and over people saying, "My 8-year-old is having a problem. My 10-year-old is having a problem."
Yes.
You know, we just recently had a mom said she noticed that her icons were moving around on her tablet PC and thought she had some sort of virus until she came down in the middle of the night and found her 8-year-old sitting in the family room watching dirty movies on mama's tablet.
Yep.
Okay, so this is something that's, we've got to be aware of this because, you know, those kids depend on their parents to run interference for them and protect them from these things.
Yeah, it's why one of the reasons why I think even questions about the average age of exposure, I think that can often give kids or give parents a sense of false security. When you say and state an average, you are stating what's in the middle of these things, right?
Right.
Have to remember, I mean, there are kids, who boys and girls both, who don't see porn until they're 16, 17, 18 years old. And then there are kids who are exposed to it when they're 5.
Yeah.
And when you're stating an average, you're finding a nice sweet spot in the middle. That can only bring a sense of false security for people. I would say that it really doesn't matter much when the average age of exposure is, because your kid isn't an average of anything. He is an individual, or she is an individual, who has got his own or her own curiosities, their own environment that they're living in. And so therefore there are 1,000 factors, both seemingly accidental and then of course intentional within the heart of the child. There's 1,000 factors that go into when do they first see this stuff. And so averages don't serve anybody in this area. We have to remember that our children were designed by God as sexual beings. And by sexual, I don't mean that they're having sex. I mean that they are curious about sexual matters, sexual information. They are gendered from conception.
Right.
They are born with anatomy, with surrounded by people who have anatomy, surrounded by people who have surrounded by relationships. So they're born into a relational world. They're born as relational beings. It's natural for them to be curious about these things. And when you mix that curiosity with an uncontrolled or unmonitored environment, then you have the potential to have problems.
Well, then let's go with that, Luke. Now, you mentioned the curiosity, and that's just, you know, frankly, that's normal. And that's one thing we tell parents is, you know, we talk a great deal about raising sons, and we warn them and say, you know what? It is natural for your son to be curious, and that's not a bad thing.
Right.
But how do you recommend you deal with this kind of thing when they have a natural curiosity and it bubbles up? And, you know, hopefully this is something that you're dealing with before they're 15 or 16, right?
Right. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I laugh because I know a number of parents, mostly long distance. They are kind of in the boat that you just shouldn't be talking about this kind of stuff till adolescence, and even then, not until late adolescence, when they're ready to get into some sort of or thinking about, or something's on the horizon for dating or courting or something like that, or when they're expressing an interest in those things. That is far too late in the game, and for a number of reasons. One is just because of the sexualized environment in which we live. People are exposed to these things early, and there is an advantage to being first. There's an advantage to laying a foundation.
You know, I can't agree more, Luke. I mean, that's something that has really struck us as we've talked with families literally all over the country. There's just that need to be the first source of information as our children are discovering. I mean, just discovering their own bodies, and
we need to start. We start early, really from birth. So we need to be thinking about teaching kids proper names for body parts when they're young. Teaching them the importance of modesty and privacy when they're young. Mm-hmm. Even just this simple action of establishing a rhythm of family devotions, establishing a rhythm of mom and dad open the Bible, they talk to the kids about what's in the Bible. That may not sound like sex ed, but it lays the foundation for that book has answers. It lays the foundation for mom and dad think that book is practical and applies to all of life.
Yeah,
and so when you do that again for sex education, it's not weird. It's not odd at all that you are, you know, opening up the Bible and talking about sex, talking about marriage, talking about intimacy, talking about relationships, talking about how babies are made, talking about any topics. It's all part of the rhythm and of the home, and that's what parents have to do in order to be first.
Well, somebody
they
made
have,
the
have
yeah.
that kind of those kind yeah. of rhythm where they are establishing themselves as the not just the sex ed teacher, but as the teacher of the home in all matters that pertain to life and godliness.
Well, somebody made the point a while back that once you've gone through the first book of the Bible, when you finish Genesis, you've covered everything. I mean, you've encountered most of the basic issues already.
Yeah, you have.
So you know what? One of the things I've found helpful is, as parents, to think through these issues beforehand and kind of go through in your mind, how will I answer these questions when, not if or whether, but when they come up, what am I going to say Because a lot of times, you know, we offer some suggestions to people in some of our presentations, and you can sense a wave of relief, like, oh, that's an illustration I can use. Whew. Okay, now I'm not going to be caught flat-footed. And there's a lot of value, like pre-reading these passages in Genesis, and say, how do you explain some of the sins that God judges in that book? How do you explain some of these commandments in a way that's appropriate for a 5-year-old versus a 10-year-old versus your 14-year-old? Because you need to have an answer for all of them.
Sure. Well, I would say, first of all, it's important in all these instances, when you're reading through the scriptures, or for that matter, if the child, him or herself, is reading through the scriptures. I mean, this has been a conversation in my home where our kids might have their own private devotions, and they come to me and they've just read something from the Bible, and they want to know what it's talking about, and it's in this sort of sexual vein. Well, it's important that if a child is being taught about, especially, let's say you're talking about kids that are like, say, 5 and younger. You know, it's not, first of all, they're not at a stage of cognitive development where you can, even if you wanted to explain things in a lot of great detail, that they're going to have the capacity to incorporate and understand what's going on. Their experience level is very low. Mm-hmm. They don't have a grid for all this kind of stuff. They don't have really a concrete set kind of learning style yet, and so it's appropriate to keep conversations brief, to not necessarily surfacey, but to highlight constantly what is godly sexuality, what does that entail? So, for instance, if you're at, say, Sodom and Gomorrah, and God's raining sulfur on it. And they're asking, well, what was so bad about what they were doing, and what were they trying to do to that woman, and what were they trying to do to those guests in the house, and what was going on? Mm-hmm. You know, say, well, God has a plan for how we're supposed to use our bodies to express love to each other. You could talk about, you know, things like good touch and bad touch, those kind of things, mm-hmm. and to say, you know, look, this stuff here that you're seeing here, this is a kind of bad touch. This isn't something that people this was meant to bring harm. This was meant to hurt, and this was meant to uncover someone's private areas of their body when that's not supposed to happen, you know, outside of the context of marriage and family and love, and that's what's happened here. And so that's a short answer that probably will be. A 5-year-old would be able to comprehend the basics of what's going on there. And it's important for that 5-year-old's life, too, at that moment, because, you know, sexual abuse starts very, very young for a lot of kids.
It's on the rise as well. It's something that
it is.
I think the pornography influence on our culture is driving more of this kind of misbehavior.
Right.
So that there is a greater risk. It's always you always feel like as a parent, the world's worse than it was when I was a child. But this is really quantifiably true.
Yeah, and really, what we're the sex abuse thing is really important for parents to cover. At least for them to recognize that. Of course, unless the parent's the instigator of it, which is heinously evil and everything, parents aren't often aware of what's going on with their children, whether it be through babysitters, through daycare workers, through friends of the family, people at their church. And so it's important to start young before a child is, you know, likely to be in that kind of situation, and to begin talking to them about this is, you know, there's people out there that might try to do these kind of things. And by say, it sounds vague. I want to be real concrete for your listeners. Right. They might try to touch you in your private areas. They might try to get you to do things with your private areas. You could use specific words. You know, use proper anatomical terms. Get them used to those words, because those words aren't bad or naughty or evil. Those are good words to use. They're proper ways to describe the physical parts of our body. Talk about all those things. Get them used to that language. It'll be very, very normal. Then by the time, you know, they're getting into a more concrete stage of development where they can now begin to think of things linearly. They can begin to think of things that they can begin to process things in a different way. This is, starts around the age of 6 or 7 for a child, and they can begin to understand better, have longer conversations with you about things. It's in that time, I'd say 6 to 7, starting around that time up until maybe 10 years old, that is a great time to start laying some of these more proactive teachings that actually get into what is more classically thought of as birds and bees kind of conversations. You've got things, you know, where you actually talk about what is sexual intercourse? What is that? What is marriage and what it's for?
Well, you know, you're talking about being concrete and at an appropriate level. And I think you made a couple of very good points there. One of them is just readiness to understand concepts. I mean, sometimes we want to be real frank with our kids, and they're just, to say too much information, it is a real thing. They simply can't process some of the things that we want to tell our older kids. But I think another thing which I think is really crucially important is you use the word context. You know, that our sexuality is part of a larger context of how God created us and the relationships that we maintain, that right. He puts us in. And as you said, you know, when you take these certain temptations, these certain feelings or desires, and you put them into the biblical context of love and commitment and marriage and holiness surrounding all of that, then that's kind of building a bulwark around our kids, so that when they are presented with this, you know, the ungodly view, the one that says this physical sensation is something that you can pursue completely independent of any sort of biblical context, they already know, hey, that's not true.
Right.
And so that's why it's important to begin that conversation, both to help them deal with their own temptations and to help them be their own first line of defense against those who would misuse them.
And I think it's important for parents to recognize that, you know, sexuality is part of a child's makeup. They are gendered from birth. You know, they have, you know, they have a sexual identity from birth that they will explore and try to understand and try to wrap their minds around. From birth, they will try to do this. They will constantly be identifying with, you know, trying to understand basics of what are boys, what are girls, why are they different. You know, they've thrown into this world where there are these differences. They will try to figure those things out on their own. It's very natural for them to do that, and it's good for them to do that. It's also, you know, people need to understand that puberty is not an on-off switch. Mm. One day you're not prepubescent, and the next day you're pubescent. It doesn't work like that. There is our adrenal cortex in our body will secrete DHEA, mm-hmm. which is which when it's metabolized leads to testosterone and estrogen, and these are primary sexually steroids. And by the age of 10, DHEA levels have increased significantly in a child. It's almost doubled since he was since the age of 4. And that, so from the age of 4 to 10, that has been gradually growing in that child. That is not an on-off switch. That is something that has been happening throughout their middle childhood years. And so physiologically, our children are growing into becoming adult men and women, probably more gradually than parents would like to admit. And so as a result, they're experiencing changes in their body and their mind long before parents often think that they are. It's important, mm-hmm. then, for parents to anticipate the fact that there is going to be, even from, say, the age of 10, there's going to be instances where children are going to experience something that is akin to attraction. Certainly not in the full sexual or even fantasizing sense that, you know, maybe their teenage counterpart would. Mm-hmm. But they're going to experience this sense of, that's alluring, that's intriguing, that's alarming. They'll have these emotional reactions to seeing things that are provocative, seeing things that are titillating. They will. It's built into the fabric of who they are. Now, it's immature. It's not understood. They don't even understand it. they don't really have a way to comprehend it. But that's okay. You know, the idea is that, you know, those feelings or emotions are, those are very normal. Those are very understandable emotions. They're good. They're built. It's part of how you've been built. Mm-hmm. If parents can anticipate that, you know, this is the kind of thing my child is going through, and even in sort of a primordial way, then they will have less of a mentality that they need to somehow that they're sort of a magical age where they need to start these sort of conversations. These conversations start very early. You build up to, you know, and always keeping the Bible at the center of it. You constantly can walk your, you know, like you were saying, if you just walk your child through Genesis, you'll cover all the bases of good and bads of sexuality in the world. You will cover all the bases. I released a Bible study on my personal website, intoxicatedonlife.com, just because I had so many parents who were struggling with this. It's basically what it is. It's sort of a blend of Bible study and biology. It's a sex ed study that is sort of devotional in nature, and it's a script. It's basically just a script. Read this passage, say these words, explain these things. Here's some little cartoony diagrams to help you understand some basic anatomy, internal anatomy stuff. Here's how babies are made. It's a real basic walkthrough, step-by-step kind of thing, 7 lessons. But it supplies a foundation for parents with their middle childhood, for kids in the middle childhood years who are able to be more concrete and kind of wrap their minds around what's being said. Mm-hmm. And I've heard some wonderful, wonderful stories from parents who utilize this and say, this is great. This is the kind of thing I've been looking for, is just a sort of a basic script for telling me how to do it. That's why I wrote it, because there's so much. I think the biggest hang up for a lot of parents is themselves. They themselves are squeamish, worried, concerned, nervous, and it's their own nerves that hold them back, not necessarily anything they're reading in their child,
right,
that's holding them back. They're fearful of their own disposition towards this.
And you know what? As parents, we are called to be courageous.
They're nervous about the topic itself. So if you can normalize it, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Yep.
And so, well, look, I appreciate you bringing that up, because I wanted to ask, can you give us the link one more time for this resource that you've got for helping parents talk about this very sensitive subject?
It's on my personal website. It's called intoxicatedonlife.com. My wife and I blog there. Started out as sort of a more or less personal blog, and it's become kind of more of a personal platform to reach the world with a lot of family-centered gospel themes. We've got a lot of stuff there, homeschooling and stuff like that. But our book is called, the book that I'm talking about is called The Talk. Mm-hmm. And The Talk, 7 Lessons to Introduce Your Child to Biblical Sexuality. And it's like I said, it's devotional Bible study meets biology. Mm-hmm. It's a script. It's a walkthrough. It's parents are doing the teaching, and it's very simple to use.
We've been talking with Luke Gilkerson. He is the educational resource manager for Covenant Eyes, a fantastic ministry. We cannot recommend them highly enough. CovenantEyes.com is where you can find them. And if you want to get that resource that Luke just mentioned, the 7 lessons to introducing your child to biblical sexuality, The Talk, you can get that at his blog, intoxicatedonlife.com. Luke, I appreciate it. There's so much that could be said about this, so much that ought to be said. Can you join us again for another discussion?
I would love to, Hal. Thank you.
Thanks so much. You've been listening to Making Biblical Family Life Practical. I'm Hal Young. My co-host and wife, Melanie Young, is not available to join us right now, but I hope you'll join us again. We're on here every Monday night at 9 p.m., or you can pick us up on iTunes, or come to the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network, and you can listen to the archives there. Thank you so much. God bless you all. You've been listening to Making Biblical Family Life Practical with Hal and Melanie Young. If you found this program interesting, challenging, and encouraging, why not join us on the web at halandmelanie.com. That's HalandMelanie.com. Or follow us on social media. You can find us on Facebook at Facebook.com/HalandMelanie or Facebook.com/RaisingRealMen. This program is a production of the Ultimate Homeschool Radio Network. Join us next week when we'll be back to talk about making biblical family life practical. Until then, thank you and God bless you for listening.